Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's a helping people. But Tom Fox talking to these funny people. He's asking what they find in the town stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's my mate, Water Toaster. Oh, it's my mate, Water Toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's my mate, Water Toaster. Toaster for my love, thank God, Toaster.
Well, hello and welcome back to episode, I think this is 9 now, wow, of series 5 of My Mate Bought a Toaster. Hello, my name is Tom Price, and I don't know why I'm telling you my name. So, please welcome my first guest, my cold. There it is. Luckily, at the time of recording this following episode, I didn't have the cold, so don't worry, you're not going to listen to me honking away. It's a very difficult time to have a cold right now. Nobody cares. So, in fact, they're actively repulsed by you if you go anywhere near them with a cold. So, yeah, enjoy the episode. Thanks for listening. George Egg, fabulous, fabulous stand-up comedian. And now, well, we'll talk about it loads. He now does these fantastic snack hacker videos, and he's a crazy performance chef, I guess you'd call him. He's a really interesting guy and a lovely, funny man to boot. So, George Egg to come. As usual, if you get a second or a chance afterwards, please go and give us a rate and review and all that business, because it does always, always help attract new people to the podcast. We have got 2 more episodes still to come this series. We've got Danny Robbins off of Uncanny. Fantastic podcast. He's coming up next week. And then we're going to finish this series with Angela Barnes. And that's the plan for My Mate Bought a Toaster, Series 5. Thanks for listening. Here's George Egg. Hello, welcome. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster, but you already knew that. My name's Tom Price. Hopefully you already knew that. Fingers crossed. What you probably don't know, actually you probably do because you've looked at the artwork, my guest today is the very brilliant comedian, food comedian, Instagram hybrid broadcasts thing. George Egg, have I summed up your career beautifully there or what?
You have. My career is impossible to sum up because I can't. I've always managed to sort of fall between categories, I think, which is advantageous and disadvantageous. But
yes.
But yeah, so that kind of jumbled summary is apt.
Do you get that thing where the professionals in your lives, the agents and so on, say to you, but what are you? I mean, maybe less now because you do have a real laser-like focus on this food thing. But in the past, because you were a fantastic stand-up comic, and you still are, I'm sure, but you were like a prop comic. Do you ever get this kind of agents saying, what are you? Who are you?
Not really agents. I mean, I've had very few agents because I'm a bit of a control freak, I think, and I've always been happy doing my own thing, and also felt like as soon as someone else is involved, it starts being steered in a different direction towards a category, you know. So sort of for example, the content I'm making at the moment, the little cooking videos online, whenever I've talked to anyone in the sort of TV world, it's been that they've sort of got, oh right, okay, they're all going to be you know doing stuff with Greggs and McDonald's. And what I like about the self-created stuff is some of them are like that, some of them are just a nostalgic recipe, some of them are just a sort of comical thing, and it can be whatever I want it to be. I seem to have avoided that situation as much as possible by either not being successful enough to get on TV or sacking agents. I think I've been around for long enough that I've kind of realized that actually what makes me happy is having creative control and going off in different directions and just being able to do what I do rather than answering to someone.
I'm glad that I've got a control freak on the show, because you're going to hate this. You've got to sit back and let me take the reins now.
I know.
I'm in there. I'm in your Amazon account as we speak. And in fact, the first 2 things you bought were in 2002.
Okay. That's a long time ago.
It's a long time ago now. And actually, one of them's really poignant because she's just passed away. A life drawing by Shirley Hughes, who died very recently. Fantastic kids author.
Oh, wow.
And artist.
I didn't know. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, there you go.
I love Shirley Hughes stuff. And that would be, well, if it's 2002, that would be when my kids were all young.
Oh.
And now they're all adults.
How old are your children now?
My youngest is 21 and my eldest is 25. And I have a middle one who's 24. Yeah, so now, I know.
Do they go to the toilets by themselves now and things like that? And do they feed themselves? It's incredible.
They feed themselves. They live elsewhere. My youngest is going to come back soon, actually, but she's been living in Wales for the last sort of three quarters of a year, working at do you know Harden Estate, the Gladstone Estate up in Flintshire?
Yes.
Yeah. She's been working there.
Lovely.
Yeah, as a baker and a grower. But she's coming home.
Wow.
But they're all very independent and doing their own things that I'm involved in. So my eldest, my son, is the camera guy on my Snack Hacker films. And and he does the animation at the start, and he does all the artwork for my shows, because he's a illustrator.
So, I mean, there I was about to go off on a thing about, do you miss your babies? And actually, all you were doing was breeding stuff.
Yeah, breeding co-creatives. It's great. It's perfect.
That's fantastic. And your son is an artist, and here you are with Shirley Hughes.
I know, isn't
your kids 20 years ago.
Oh. Do you know what's funny, Tom? Because I listened to, some of the episodes and thought this is a great idea. And then I looked through my Amazon history and thought, it's all boring like that. But immediately you've got something to do. Yeah, it's good. It's good. Yeah, it's a good. I know other people have said it's a good idea. It's a really good idea. But yes, so there you go. Shirley Hughes, illustrator and... son illustrator. Yeah.
Do you when you watch your kids become an illustrator or with your, in the case of your daughter, going off to Flintshire and do these things, is there a sense that you have done anything to do with that, or are you just like, I don't know? Because, like, for example, my little boy, he's 9, my eldest is 9, and he's amazing at football. I've done nothing to facilitate that, and it's the strangest feeling. It's paranormal to watch them be sentient, basically.
I agree. I mean, I kind of thought one of them might go into performing in some way, and none of them have. They've all gone into creative pursuits, sort of artistic kind of directions. My middle one is a fashion designer and teaches at a fashion school, and she's really flying. But they're all, apart from I suppose the youngest too, because she's doing something to do with food, that's kind of in a similar direction. But it's lovely just watching them go off in their own directions. And I mean, there's got to be influence, I suppose, buying Shirley Hughes books for, they didn't buy it, I bought it, so
yeah, take the credit.
So there's definitely influence there, isn't there? But
I mean, technically your son should pay you back for that now, because his influence is correct.
Well, which so. I suppose he is, by doing the filming for a very very low fee.
and
early George Egg posters done for nothing, so there you go. So I've definitely got my money's worth.
I was probably gigging with you at this point. It's funny to think of you, you've got this Shirley Hughes book at home and you're setting off to go and do your stand-up, because your routine for years was, gosh, I can remember the bowling ball. That's the thing I remember most of all. But it was all, you get your suitcase out. And how long were you doing that kind of physical comedy thing before the cooking explosion happened in your life?
For over 20 years.
Wow.
So here's the interesting thing. Going back to kids, I was really uncreative when the kids were growing up. So I did, I mean, I kind of created the prop show in the late 90s, really, and it barely changed. I mean, it evolved really gradually, and a joke that became totally out of date just sort of drifted off and other new bits popped in. But I never consciously went, right, I'm gonna rewrite this, I'm gonna write new material. It just, because it was working and I was getting enough work, and I think I was focusing my sort of creative energy on being a parent and doing building in the house and just kind of family stuff. And if I look at when I started actually becoming creative on stage again and doing the cooking stuff, that coincides exactly, well, kind of 6 years ago, six, 7 years ago, when my youngest was sort of 15, 16, and just reaching that point where suddenly going, well, actually they're they don't need me in the same way. So yeah. I can start doing, you know.
I suspect lots of writers and artists listening to the show will be currently throwing their children out of the house.
Yeah, so going, why did I start so late? Why didn't I have kids when I was barely in my 20s?
But it gives truth to that saying, doesn't it? That nothing stifles creativity more than the pram in the hall. There's that. Evelyn Waugh,
right,
someone
heard
that.
Makes total sense. Or not. In fact, I wouldn't agree. I wouldn't say it stifles creativity. It just redirects it. So I think...
Yes.
Because I think I was really creative. I think I was a good parent. And I'm a good parent, but I think, and, you know, and did a lot of, like I said, about building, you know, we got a house and literally remodeled it from the top floor down. You know, every room has been changed, walls have been moved, and you know, most, I mean, the room I'm in now, this is one of my daughter's bedrooms, and like that wall there, that was all knocked down. It's a loft room, and I, you know,
yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so I wasn't not being creative.
I love the podcast veering into grand designs territory. Now I'm suddenly feeling all Kevin
McLeod.
Maybe
that would be my next.
That's the next thing to do. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. @ToasterPod is the name we're trying to jam. It's simple like a sarnie filled with cheese and ham. @ToasterPod, I swear it's not a scam, I think. 10th of November 2003, you bought the Nightclub Years 1964 a live audio CD of Woody Allen.
Oh, his stand-up's just...
Oh.
I mean, I know he's sort of, you know, controversial now and everything, but regardless of that, you know, if you can separate the artist from the... or the art from the person or whatever. I mean, his stand-up's just phenomenal and so influential. And I haven't listened to a lot of stand-up. When I started out, I was, before I started out, really, I was really into Eddie Izzard, and I had all his early audio cassettes that yes. I listened to endlessly and knew yes. backwards.
Did you let Eddie Izzard's voice sort of come into your stand-up? Because I think there were a lot of comments when I was starting
did.
In about yeah exactly. It was like yes sir like okay it was all this kind of Izzard-esque yeah.
Well, I think that's, you know, people sort of obviously there's the huge taboo in stand-up about copying, but I think everyone is definitely influenced at the start, and you do end up, although, you know, taking a joke is obviously, you know, a big no-no, but certainly adopting other people's styles is a way of, I think, finding your own voice. And there's an interview with him on CD that I bought, that I can't remember who the interviewer is. It's a series of interviews, and I bought three of them. I think George Carlin was one and Jerry Seinfeld is the other. And I mean, they're almost like early podcasts because they were recorded in the I don't know, 80s or something. And they just make for fascinating listening, just about how he structures his jokes and how he, you know, jots down all these, just whenever he has an idea, he says that he just jots it down on a receipt or a bit of paper or whatever, puts it in a drawer. And then when he goes, right, I'm going to start writing, pulls the drawer out, just gets them out one at a time and goes, okay, what can I do with this? And
really?
Yeah. And then
at the same time, presumably he's doing his tax return. I mean, that's a genius.
Well, exactly. You know, yes. Just turn it over, put that on the spike.
Yes. I really long for one of those spikes, one of those receipt spikes. You still see them in restaurants. They look like the deadly. I mean, there must be a certain number of people who are killed by those receipt spikes every year.
Yes, they feel like from some sort of farcical murder thing, using it like a rapier. You know,
yes,
lunging.
That's right. But someone, you can imagine the accident happening. Someone would sort of start a slight trip by the door of an all bar one or something. That's where you often see them, some sort of chain pub. And the trip would just go and go through all the tables, and eventually they'd end up with their heads slamming onto the bar. I've really thought this through. I don't quite know.
I had one of those. I did have one of those spikes for a while, and I lost it or something or other, and I bought another one, and it was one that was shaped like, I suppose, for safety reasons, instead of just being a vertical spike, it was it went up and then it went like the top of a coat hanger, like a shepherd's crook. So to put a receipt on, you had to kind of bend it round and down, and it was just really frustrating. The ease of the boff spike is much better.
Well, also there's a certain anger in just going, just slamming it down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Between the fingers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, God, don't start with that.
Imagine. If it's like a magic trick.
Talking of which, that leads us nicely to the 2nd of December 2004, George Egg. How to Ride Your Unicycle. This is a paperback by Charlie Dancy or Dancy. Right. Tell us a bit about this. Is this you?
Well, it's me purchasing it for my daughter. So, look, hey, this is really interesting because it's, like I was saying, about trying to push your children in a direction that you think they ought to be going in because it's what you do. So when I started out, I was a street entertainer and I did like a show with juggling and fire eating and all that kind of malarkey. Mm. And I bought my middle child, Zoe. She learned to ride a bike when she was three, which is pretty good to ride, you know, to ride a two wheel bike.
Yes.
And so then we bought her a unicycle and she learned how to ride that. She was seven and it was a tiny little unicycle and she'd ride it up and down the road. So that's not bad, is it?
But that is the sort of natural progression of your sentence there, that everyone listening will have gone, what? Yeah, so she learned how to ride a bike and then obviously we bought her a unicycle. That's what you do next.
Well, I learned to ride a unicycle when I was a teenager. So I thought, well, come on, that's what you've got to do. And then she'll go in the same direction as me. And then she didn't at all. She ended up going to clothes.
But can she still ride a unicycle?
I don't know if it's something that goes away. I haven't tried riding one for... decades it must be. So right, I don't know. But I think it's like any of those kind of balance things like swimming or spinning a basketball on your finger. I think it's almost like once you've got it, it can't, I mean, I'm sure it would take a bit of practice or juggling, you know. It's like you can't unlearn how to juggle.
That.
Yeah.
You never forget. As the famous phrase goes, you never forget how to ride a unicycle. That's a well-known.
It's a classic. I've got it on in cross stitch somewhere. No, I haven't.
Yeah, yeah. but also, I imagine, are you in, where are you in this, at this point? Are you in Brighton at this point?
What year is this again?
2003 or 2004, yes.
2004. Yes, so my daughter would have been seven. Yeah, I moved to Brighton when I was 19.
Okay.
And so I was brought up in South London in Forest Hill.
Right.
And I moved to Brighton for university, which is where I met Mrs. Egg, doing the same degree as me, and then we settled here.
And when did you the sort of the street entertainer thing? Did that start in Brighton? Because it strikes me that Brighton's quite fertile ground for that kind of business.
No, that started in London. So when I was at school doing my A levels, I had a Saturday job in Covent Garden working at the YHA Adventure Centre.
And
selling rucksacks and, you know, walking boots and that kind of thing.
Yeah,
And I went to see a circus called Archaos, who were this amazing French circus that toured in the late 80s, early 90s. And they were just a really absurd show, really anarchic. They didn't have any animals. They had all like cars that fell apart and fire and chainsaws and like heavy metal music playing while they were doing that. It was great. It's just an amazing experience. Really just crazy attitude towards health and safety and everything. And me and my friend Leo went to see them and just were totally blown away. And so that's when we got into juggling. And then we started trying to, we were inspired. We watched the street entertainers at lunchtime and thought, well, let's do something like this. So we put together a show and went down to Greenwich because it was a bit less intimidating than Covent Garden because there were fewer performers there and it wasn't such a sort of established thing.
Covent Garden is the Albert Hall of street entertainers, isn't it? Surely.
So thought like we'd want to go there straight away. If we want to go, who are you? You know, yeah, it's quite sort of territorial. So we went down to Greenwich and we'd practice this show in Leo's garden and went down there. It wasn't very successful. We made a little bit of money, but it wasn't like a proper show. And then the next week I said to Leo, like, we need to go down next week and do it again. And he said, oh, I think we should rehearse more. And I said, I think the best way to rehearse is just going and doing it. And he said, well, I'm not really up for it. So I threw together a show, you know, blatantly, nicking bits from other people's shows just to try and do something. and went down the following weekend by myself, did two shows either side of rain showers, made about 40 quid. Which
that'll do nicely.
Yeah, which was more than I would be earning, you know, doing a whole day's work at my Saturday job. Yeah. So gave up the job and then never looked back. So did Greenwich for a while, then started working at Covent Garden as well.
Yeah.
Then through that got sort of, you know, contracted gigs in shopping centres and started getting festivals and things like Glastonbury and stuff.
Right.
Yeah, and then moved to Brighton. So when I was doing my degree in Brighton, I didn't have a Saturday. Well, I had a Saturday job in that what I'd do is I'd get the train up to London at the weekend and work at Covent Garden, and that you know financed my sort of, you know, extra money through university.
You make it sound very easy. Like, I just went down there and did some street training. So did you have to learn how to juggle? Did you have to learn how to do all the stuff?
Yeah.
How much training did you have to do? You can't just rock up and start blowing fire at your face.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can.
No, well, I mean, you can in the sense that I just learning from books just got, you know, I got this absurd book. I can't remember where I bought it from, some magic company. It's like a little pamphlet, and it's obviously reprinted from the early 20th century, and it's got all the tricks in there. Like, I mean, I don't know if you ever worked with me when I used to bang a nail in my head. Did I ever do that?
Oh, George, I did. I'd forgotten.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. So that was like right at the start. So I mean, it's just a kind of, you know, sideshow trick where you can the cavity that you breathe in goes, you know, directly sort of back towards the back of your skull.
Can I say, to be fair, every time I do a lateral flow, I think of you.
Oh, really? Because, lateral flows have been easy for me.
yeah. But I bet there's nothing up there. Because you don't go up, you go back. And I remember you saying to me, you just sort of go back.
Yeah, it's just parallel with the roof of your mouth, the cavity, you know, just where you breathe. But so you can bang a, you know, well, you can slide a nail in, and if you grip it with your fingers and use a hammer, it looks like you're banging it in, but actually it's just sliding in. Like if you were, sorry, bang my microphone there. If you were in hospital and having a tube put down your throat, you know, that's where it would slide in. So I learned how to do that, and I learned how to do fire eating and juggling. I got a video from some other sort of, you know, circus company place. Just me and Leo taught ourselves how to juggle, and then inspired by this circus through this show together, and then my show, when I started doing it myself, it was much more like a street entertainer show with all, you know, having one trick near the end and building up to it, and, you know, and then doing the bottling speech. And
yes, they love a pad, don't they? They love a bit of padding.
It's all
street
padding.
Entertainers.
Well, that was what was really interesting was going from doing street entertaining to doing stand-up,
right?
Because it was the complete opposite. So the whole point of doing a street entertaining show is not really doing anything, because you don't want to lose, you don't want people to walk away.
Yes,
you know, building up to doing something without you know, letting people know you're going to do this big thing at the end, but not doing it until right at the end, and just before you do it, then doing the kind of slight guilt trip speech, going, "This is what I do for a living." Then doing the big trick, and then when you've all got them, then they come forward and they put the money in your hat. But then doing, so while I was doing street entertaining, then I started doing Up the Creek, because Malcolm Hardy was really you know, into more off the wall stuff.
Yeah, he was out there, man. He was brilliant.
Yeah, and he really took me under his wing, and so I went and did an open spot there, because there was another street entertainer called Brian who used to do Up the Creek, and he said, "Oh, you should go and do it." And it was quite local to me, so I went down and did an open spot there, and Malcolm gave me a gig, and then I did Up the Creek when I was 19, which is...
Wow. So that was your first stand-up gig then, when you were 19?
Yeah, 30 years ago, wow. Later this year. I'll be 49 this year. I know. So 30 years. That's not a bad... is it?
Yeah, that's good, man. 30 years not out as well. Still going strong. Stronger and stronger every day, George Egg. All right, good. Look, who we've got on... this is interesting. This is interesting. 5th of May 2006. Some interesting kind of tech stuff. Macromedia Flash MX 2004 for Dummies. Dreamweaver MX 2004 for Dummies. Is that for building websites? Is that what you're buying there?
Yeah. I tried to... I did an evening class... evening, like a course of evening classes in in Dreamweaver in building websites, because I thought, when was that? 2007, did you say?
No, earlier than that, 2006.
Really? 2006. Wow.
Yeah.
God, I didn't know it was that long ago.
This is
terrifying, actually, isn't it?
Yeah,
because you suddenly go, oh yeah, I think I did that course about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. I do that with my clothes. I do that with my clothes all the time. I've had these jeans for like 2 years. Oh no, the pandemic has been 2.5 years and they were old at the beginning of the pandemic. Therefore, Tom, do some very quick maths. Yeah. It's terrifying.
No, it's bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just thought it would be useful to have another string to my bow, I think, at that time. And I didn't have a website. And being the control freak that I am, I thought, well, I'm not going to let someone else do it. I'll do it myself.
It's interesting that people who do what you might look at your career, George, what you do, you look and think anarchic, crazy, out there, creative, all these kind of words would come to mind. But actually, massive control freak, basically running a tight corporation that happens to be called George Egg.
Towers.
Yeah, but that's what we do. That's what all these people do. Whenever you see, whether it's a street entertainer, a podcaster, an artist, whatever it is, we treat our businesses like they are a one-man Starbucks. Maybe not as aggressive as Starbucks, but you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. And when you look at an Amazon history, you see someone, you know, taking time out to improve the business and thinking about these things. You have to do it. It's not just chaos. You don't just sit around going, yeah, just scratch my ass and wait for jokes to come.
Yeah, no, I think people outside of the industry do, yeah, just sort of like, well, what do you do when you're not on stage? It's like, well, all the other stuff, you know.
Oh my God, it drives me mad. The two questions you should never ask a stand-up comedian, tell us a joke and what do you do in the daytime?
Yeah. In fact, the other two that I think you should never ask them is, have you got an agent? So this is a thing when we used to, like, you know, we'd go to like a sort of social gathering of people who vaguely know what I do. And then two of the questions I'd always ask would be, have you got an agent? And you know, I have had agents on and off, but like I say, I kind of, you know,
killed them. You murdered
looking
them.
After myself. Yeah. I murdered their, So they say, have you got an agent? You go, no, I self-represent. And you can just see them kind of going, oh, you're not really. And then they go, do you do the comedy store? Because it's the only one they've heard of. And you go, no, not really, because it's not, you know, he's not, the guy books it, he's not really into stuff that's a bit more off the wall. And they're like, oh, right, okay. And then they wander off and, you know, they're going, oh, she's unlucky, you know, being married to him is some loser.
That's it. And if you said to them, you know, what do you do? They say, I'm a consultant. And you're like, well, do you ever work with PricewaterhouseCoopers?
Yeah.
Do you consult the government of Great Britain? No, I don't. Ah, well, probably not the real deal then. Toast them all, my love, thank God, toast them.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Look at this, 2008, the Opinel Slimline knife. You've bought a knife here, George.
I think there's quite a few of those knives. Do you know what? It's just a really, that Opinel knife is, I tell you why I bought that. I did a, and this is. I mean, I've been into cooking for as long as I've done stand-up and only started doing the cooking on stage shows sort of 6-7 years ago. But I did a few courses, like birthday presents, you know, at cooking schools. And I did one all about fish and fish filleting. And so I bought that really thin knife because it's quite flexible. And that's great for filleting fish. And most of the shows have used bits that I've learned at these cookery classes. So the first show I filleted, the hotel cooking show, I filleted a fish live on stage because I just thought that would, you know, I thought that's a cool thing to be able to do stand up while you're filleting a fish really neatly. And that's where I learned how to fillet the fish. And it's just a great knife for filleting fish, that Opinel, that really thin one. So there's two more there that I think I bought, one for my dad and one for my brother.
Look. May 2009, we go again with the Opinel. £18.86. It's the 12-centimeter slimline knife, guys. I'll put a link out on the Toaster Pod
Twitter. It looks like
account.
A really sort of nasty kind of teddy boy kind of, you know, like you could really just in and out just right under the ribcage.
The person that owning that, it's got a kind of Peaky Blinders, I'll cut ya sort of vibe to
it. It has, hasn't it?
And you're doing the most bourgeois thing. I'm just filleting a fish, a poisson. What is the what's the trickiest fish to fillet? Because it's quite a tricky thing to do, isn't it, filleting a fish?
Do you know what? It's not as tricky as people. It's actually quite easy. I mean, it depends on the fish. So, like a mackerel's got really big bones, so that's really easy. Something like a trout's a bit. Or of herring, because they've got really, really fine bones, and then you've got to get in with the tweezers and just, you know, pinbone all the little ones out. But
I was always terrified, because we were lucky enough to live near a river when I grew up. My brothers used to fish, and they used to get trout, and we used to eat their trout. Very idyllic, sounds like something Arthur Ransom has come up with. But the problem was, I was terrified of eating trout, because my parents were so, like, would tell stories about people choking on trout bones. To this day, I don't enjoy fish, because I'm scared.
Yeah, no, do you know what? I love fish, but when I was a child, I was so anxious about it. My parents would get whole fish and cook them, you know, and I'd just be so, and if I got the slightest tickle, I'd just be like, real panicky little boy, you know.
Yeah.
I was so fussy when I was small. I was really, because I'm really into food and cooking now, but, you know, if my parents had spaghetti bolognese, I'd just want spaghetti with grated cheese on it. It was really,
really
difficult to eat it when I was little. Yeah.
How interesting. How funny to think you've gone full circle. And were your kids good eaters?
Yeah, they really were, actually. Mm. We were just very conscious of, because when I was small, I you know, like I'd say, I go, oh, I don't want to have that. And so they give me an alternative. And we, right from the start, just thought, we won't be tough, but we'll just make sure they eat what we eat. And so as soon as they started eating food as opposed to drinking breast milk, we got this really cool little, it's from Mothercare or somewhere. It's like a little sort of plastic pot with a manual grinding device at the top.
Oh yeah.
And whatever we were having for dinner, we'd put spoonfuls of that in, grind it up, and then so that they had the same thing.
Like
so
a sort of
curry or...
Like a sort of Mothercare Nutribullet.
Yeah.
Just whiz it up for them.
It was a manual, so it was just, so you just ground it by hand. So it was sort of roughly chopped. So, you know, so it was a sort of a plastic masticator. So it was like, you know, sort of animals in the wild will chew up their food in their mouth and then...
Oh my God, yes. You were like the blackbird in the nest and you were about to spit it out into your child's mouth. Let's not dwell too much on that image.
But using a device from Mothercare to do it.
Thanks, Mothercare.
But yeah, so we gave them, so their curry and everything. And so they've never been... they've never really been fussy at all. But the only problem with that is then they would have friends come round. And then they'd be fussy. And that's something I can't abide to get really, you know.
The chips and nuggets and ketchup brigade.
Yes, and just like, and what's this? You know, it's a little bit of black pepper on there. Oh, I can't eat it. And just, you know.
You'd have a nightmare with my children, mate. Can I send, maybe you should do that. You should start up some sort of camp for kids who are crap at eating, and I'll send both my boys to
you know.
That'd be great.
That was a thought I have. Because I think when, before I started doing the cooking shows, I had a real, the only time I've ever done a job, you know, because of going straight, you know, apart from Saturday jobs and then going to street entertaining from there to stand up and so on. About, I don't know, 10 years ago now, maybe 9 or 10 years, you'll see there's loads of books on lecturing, and I started doing a PGCE to become a design technology teacher, and I went into a school and hated it and just thought I can't do it. Well, I had two weeks at university doing all the lectures on being a teacher, and I thought, this is fascinating. I'm gonna be a great I'm gonna be such a good teacher. Oh, I'm gonna be like Dead Poets Society. It was just I'm gonna be amazing. And then went into a school in Worthing High,
right?
And the first had one day there, and then that evening when I got home, my mentor rang me. He's a really nice guy, and he said, look, I feel really awkward saying this, but the deputy head's been in touch, and she said, when you come in tomorrow, can you not wear your, because I just have an earring in one ear, can you not wear your earring?
Oh, no.
And can you not wear, I have a skull ring that I like to wear. and said, can you not wear those? And I said, okay. And then the next day I went in without them, and then, and I'd lasted a couple of days and just thought, I can't. I mean, from, you know, from the age of 16, being my own boss.
Do you think that's still the case now for teachers? Are teachers allowed to wear that sort of stuff?
I think it depends on the school. So I went, so the lady at the university who was, you know, my main sort of tutor, when I, you know, so I went after a few days, I went to see her and I said, look, I don't think I can do this. And she said, oh, I sent you to the wrong school. I should have sent you here. And, but she was really understanding. I said, look, you know, I've kind of made my decision now.
Yeah.
But yeah, how do we start talking about that?
I'm just sort of fast. I think fish bones. I think that's how we got onto teaching, through fish bones.
Right? How do we get from the fish bones to that?
No. Anyway, the listeners will know. It's fine. We got there. Yeah. I'm interested in this idea of you sort of, you know, exploring other avenues. You were obviously fidgety about stand up and you were looking elsewhere, and stand up wasn't floating your boat. Because by this point, we're nearly at the time where you start doing the cooking thing. What year did you start the cooking thing?
So I did Edinburgh the first time in 2015.
Right.
But I did Brighton Fringe the year before. So 2013, 2014 is when it started.
I have such a clear memory of seeing that poster. I think it was Brighton. I think I was at that Brighton Fringe that year because I was doing Edinburgh 2014, and I saw George Egg doing cooking. What, the guy who does the bowling ball in the soup? What's going on there? I mean, it's like a complete reinvention. It must have been terrible. What, that moment when you walked out on stage to do not your absolutely rigid, tight, locked down, bulletproof 20 minutes, that must have been terrifying.
Yeah, it really was. I was so nervous about it. And I did... So what had happened is I did the... For a number of years, I'd done Robin Ince's Christmas shows, the Bloomsbury Theatre. I'd made some little films of me cooking in hotel rooms, just for fun, just as something to do while I've been, you know, spending a weekend at the Glee, stuck in a Holiday Inn, and I thought, well, I'll do a live thing of that, and so I wrote a 10-minute routine of me cooking on irons. On an ironing board, and
yes, I remember that. Yes.
And someone from Brighton Fringe came up to me at one of those and said, "Are you doing Edinburgh?" And I said, "Oh God, no! You know, I've never done nothing like that." And she said, "Well, why don't you do Brighton Fringe?" And she was the lady who ran the other place venues upstairs at the 3 and 10, and so I ummed and ahed about it, and then it was quite late, I think in February or March, I said, look, can I do it? And she said, well, look, we'll try and find you a gap, but it's, you know, May is when the Fringe is. And she found me a gap, and it was that thing that I'd heard other comedians talk about of, you know, you book in and you self enforce a deadline.
Yeah.
And then you have to come up with the goods. And so I suddenly went, right, I've got sort of, you know, 9 weeks to turn this into a 1-hour show. And so then just, you know, and had to.
It's wonderful, and then it came together. You know, you say you've got 9 weeks. What I'm seeing here as I trawl through your Amazon purchase history, the book of tapas, preserves, the River Cottage Handbook number 2, more and more food stuff that you're buying along the way. So it's coming out, and you can see, and this is 2011 now. So you're saying you had a 9-week deadline. What you didn't realize was that this had been fermenting away inside you.
Yeah.
You were,
oh no,
stuck,
it really
on the
had.
Circuit.
Mm. No, and it was, and once I started, well, like once I, so because it was the first show was the hotel cooking show. So I had the irons and I had the pancakes and the irons, because that was the routine that I'd written for the Robin Ince thing. So I went, right, okay, I've got, and that was about 15 minutes, but I had to pull it down to 10 minutes for their show. So I thought, okay, well, that's 15, probably with a bit of blah, 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 you know, that's 20 minutes. So that's a third of the show.
Yes.
So then I thought, okay, so I'll do 3 dishes. So I've got to come up with 2 others. And things like going, all right, I'll do something with fish. Oh, well, I did that course at the Jamie Oliver Cookery School thing, hence the knives.
Look, again, we're seeing the seeds of stuff here. The Triangia, 25...
Triangia.
There you are. That's a 25 non-stick cook set. Tell us about this.
It's just the best camping cooker. It's really lightweight. You cook with meths on it, but you can cook with all sorts of different stuff. A friend of mine went traveling in, he was in the Himalayas, and he bought some local sort of spirit and used that as the fuel because it was cheap.
Because it was strong enough.
Yeah, so literally using, some sort of vodka and setting fire to that and cooking with that as the...
I love that. Also, there's a definite trope here, which is the dad brands. My dad was like this, I'm like this. There are certain brands I'm like, they're the best ones. Like Sony, for no apparent reason, I'm like, you've got to get Sony TV. Yeah, it's the thing.
Yes, my dad used to have Sony TVs. Well, my dad, he had NAD Hi-Fi, and it was always like, oh yeah, NAD's the one.
That's the best one. It's completely arbitrary. It's complete bollocks, probably. But we stick with it. My dad was Volvos. Always. Everything had to be a fucking Volvo every year.
Mine was Renaults. Mine was Renaults and then became Citroens and then Saabs near the end.
I love that. I love the sort of mundanity of hearing a brand loyalty come out in you, George. That was great. you could take the eccentric artist and actually he's like, no, they're the best camping stoves, mate. You've got to get those or you're dead in the water.
But they really are.
Stab can opener, 25th of January 2013. There you are, you're stabbing cans.
That's a real nostalgia thing. So I used to love evaporated milk when I was a little boy, and I still like it. I love it in coffee. Switzerland.
It's just very sugary milk.
I don't think it's got any added sugar. I think the sugar is concentrated because it's kind of reduced. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure how evaporated milk is made. I guess they evaporate some of the water and it's just concentrated and then preserved. Yeah. But yes, and so one of those little stab, you pierce a hole in opposite sides of the top of the can and then you can pour it so the air can get in the other side. But they used to be used for beer, I think. And there's a great euphemism for those little can stabbers. They're often called the church key, which is lovely, isn't it?
That is... But because they're so sort of size and dimensions and what, and they,
I think, and I think because I don't know why it's euphemistic for opening a can of beer, but
I guess because you're opening the doors to paradise, I imagine.
Yeah, something like that. It's great, isn't it? The church key. So I still call it the church. I say, pass me the church key.
Oh, that's good. That's good knowledge. Someone somewhere this summer is going to be at a festival and they're going to say, pass us the church key, and they're going to feel fucking cool. You are welcome, guys. Thank you, George. That's brilliant. Look at this. 10th of July, 2015, the galvanised dustbin. You've bought a bin there, George. Always love a nice... good. That's a really good old-fashioned...
Love a dustbin.
Bin. It's a good old-fashioned... That's proper my old man's a dustbin.
It's a top cat bin, isn't it?
It's a top cat bin. Yes. Thank you. I was scrabbling around there. It is a top cat bin. Yes.
That's funny talking to I guess because I snore and I will like to sort of read sort of late into the night and have a light on. So Mrs. Egg has taken to wearing an eye mask and earplugs in bed. And I remember telling Dan Evans about that and he just said, like Top Cat. I thought it was really funny.
fantastic. Also with a beautifully filleted fish as well, like Top Cat.
Exactly.
There you go.
In fact, one of the lines in the first show, when I fillet the sea bass, I hold up the skeleton and I go, it's not bad. It's not quite Top Cat, but it's pretty good. Yes, that's a line from the show.
Fantastic. look, 2017, George, we can see what's going on. Your whole life has become about this show now. Pick Cuco, the cookbook, hog, proper pork recipes from the snout to the squeak.
Oh, yeah.
You've also bought Soft Grip Junior Hacksaw. Is that to attack the pig with? Is that what's going on here?
I think that was for tomatoes. It's a nice little one for doing. That was for doing tomatoes, slicing tomatoes in the show. So that was for the DIY chef show. Yeah. So it was all cooking with power tools and hand tools and that sort of thing. So I think there'll be various things in there that would be bought for the show.
There's a kind of steampunk / hipster approach to this stuff. You can imagine your things that you do on stage a week later appearing in restaurants in Hackney.
Definitely.
We've got the coal shovel, a 6-inch coal shovel. You're going to be serving up food on a coal shovel, aren't you?
I think I was using it as a cooking device. So I was putting, in fact, I know for a fact because I do it in the show, still when I do that show, I put croutons in there or little cubes of bread and then use a hot air gun to toast them to make croutons.
Oh, lovely. All right, George, we're running out of time. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to come charging into the present and see what's going on in your life right now. Okay, that is the plan. We have just had arrived some solid rectangle rubber seal strip. Oh, I love a rubber seal strip. Yes, please.
That is for... So I'm building a roof garden on... we have a garage next to the house and I'm building a roof garden out there. And I built some window boxes and the roof is slightly uneven. So to make them sit perfectly parallel, I bought some rubber strip to fix to the underside of the window boxes to make them so that they sit perfectly level, but rubber will be nice and a lot of friction so they're not going to blow off in the wind.
Oh, very that's nice. For. Very good. Tremendous detail. 16 professional nail files. Is this for you, George?
No.
Okay.
I bite my nails terribly. This is a habit that I've got.
Oh,
it's
yes.
A terrible habit. And also I'm really conscious of it now because I'm making these snack hacker videos, which I must tell everyone about, the snack hacker videos. Which has been my basically my latest creative thing during lockdown that's taken over everything else, really. But yes, in those, there's close-ups of me doing things with my fingers, and sometimes I look at the rushes and go, sort it out, George, stop biting.
You need to get a hand model, or you, I think, is it bitumen, the stuff they use in that's mouse poison? You paint it on your fingernails, and it's so disgusting, doesn't it actually kill you? It's so disgusting, you don't bite them.
Well, the thing, I've tried the, well, stop and grow, you know, the stuff that tastes really revolting, but I just managed to sort of acquire a taste for it, really. It's kind of go, it's a bit like Campari. You
know? Nice. If anything, it's making me chew my nails even more. Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's the problem, isn't it? I'm a terrible nail chewer. They don't get very short, but I'm always hacking away at them. It drives my wife absolutely mad.
And I do the bits down the stupidly, like nibble the you know, the skin down the sides, and then it's terrible.
Is it a nervous thing? Are you a nervous? You're a highly strung man. You're not particularly.
No, I'm not. I'm really quite relaxed. I've no idea. I don't know. Don't know why. And I've really thought, you know, I've got to stop. And then suddenly it's when I'm driving, actually, it's the worst.
Right.
So, you know, I'll drive to a gig and suddenly, you know, be pulling into the car park and go, what have I done? And I've just torn them apart.
Oh, you know what you should do? You know what you should do? It'll sort it out. Take up smoking.
Yeah, maybe.
It'll really occupy your fingers then. It'd be great. It's very good for you as well. So something to think about. So the Snack Hacker Vids, George, that leads us nicely onto a healthy plug at the end of this. Tell us about Snack Hacker. It's a fantastic idea. And a simple one. Why hasn't someone done this before?
I don't know. So in lockdown, I was obviously unable to perform on stage and just needed some sort of creative outlet, I suppose. So I started making little videos to put on my Instagram of me interfering with existing snacks. So like I'd buy a Greg's pasty, I'd nibble the edge off, I'd put other ingredients inside and eat it and talk about it. And they're really short. They're like 2 minutes long each. I have guests. So I've had sort of, you know, used my connections to the comedy industry and had people like Matt Lucas come up with their ideas. And Tim Key did a brilliant one. He, so he said that he made a kebab risotto once, and he sent me a video of him describing how he made this kebab risotto, like waking up the next morning after finding half a kebab from a sort of drunken night the day before, and using the kebab meat to make a risotto. And so I recreated his kebab risotto and put my own twist on it, put some tahini in it, and anyway, it ended up being a really delicious dish. And So started making these little videos, putting them on Instagram in November 2020.
Right.
And they just captured people's interest. The Lad Bible did some edits of them. And I went from 4,000 followers to I've got over 55,000 now. And with the Lad Bible edits, they've had over 7 million views. And
The snack hacker thing's amazing. And also it points to what you've always done in your career. So you were a kind of circus guy and you brought that to stand up. And then you did circus on stand up for years. And then you basically took being a stand-up and injected that into the world of food, and sort of you take things with you, and now you've got the sort of foodiness, now you're taking that into social media. So it's the next step for you, isn't it? It's an exciting progression, right?
Yeah. And it's a bit of everything. So it's a bit of the sort of innovation of the live show, you know, the live cooking shows, and there's stand-up in the videos as well. Mm. And then, but there's also just real straight recipes too. And
helpful.
A lot of nostalgic stuff.
Yes.
So it's, yeah, it just feels like, and going back to what we're talking about being a control freak, it's my thing totally. So I can make each episode however I want. There's no one there saying,
Brilliant. No,
they've all got to be about pasties or burgers or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I can just do one that's just a snack that my dad made me when I was a little boy and get quite, you know, gushing about that.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a lovely thing. You're a lovely man. George Egg, as a control freak, I find this a bit difficult. I'm going to hand control of your Amazon account back to you. This is always a sad moment for me. I'm logging out and I'm leaving. But I've enjoyed walking around. It's been wonderful in there.
I've really enjoyed this.
Thanks, mate.
I know everyone says it, but it's such a good idea. It really is, though.
There you go. That was today's episode of My Mate Bought a Toaster. As ever, thank you so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to contact the show at ToasterPod on Twitter or Instagram, or just give us a follow. That would be nice. I enjoy being followed like Jesus. Right, that's quite enough of that. I'll see you next week. Bye now.
Patreon.com/ToasterPod
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.